Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, took the top spot this weekend at the box office, and that should be good news for the first state. Why? Well, as you may or may not know, the Hollywood blockbuster is actually Delaware-based. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Starting off our show, WHYY's Mark Eichmann explains how Delaware became the home of several comic book settings.
Stay down! If I wanted it, you'd be dead already!
As Superman and Batman duke it out on the big screen this spring, many moviegoers may be surprised to find out that the Man of Steel's hometown of Metropolis is actually in Delaware. From his first appearance in 1938's Action Comics No. 1, Superman has been the king of superheroes, spawning TV shows, cartoons, and several film franchises, including the latest iteration, Batman vs. Superman: Dawn of Justice. But according to DC Comics lore, Superman's adopted home, Metropolis, is actually in the first state. Surprised? Joe Murray was.
It made me mostly confused.
Murray is the owner of Captain Bluehead Comics in Newark, Delaware. He has the backstory on Superman's somewhat secret identity as a Delaware resident.
In 1990, there was a DC role-playing game guide that had a map in it that showed Metropolis, about where Dover is. It has been addressed in some other comics. I believe there was a World's Finest strip, which actually also showed Metropolis in Delaware.
That DC Comics map that placed Metropolis in Delaware also puts Batman's home of Gotham City just across the Delaware Bay in New Jersey. And for a state with less than a million residents, the idea that such a mega city should be located in Delaware is a bit odd.
Part of Delaware's appeal for comics is that they could put that there and not really worry about that many people complaining or not recognizing and going, hey, this isn't accurate, since there is a bit of question as to what Delaware is all about.
Retired Delaware State Archivist Russ McCabe says he used to get questions about Metropolis during his time at the public archives.
I'm guessing that the folks that used that in the comic strip originally probably didn't have a clue as to where Delaware even was or what was there.
But Joe Murray thinks the Metropolis in Delaware idea might not be as exciting as it sounds, depending on which version of the megacity you look at. Comic book version or the grittier movie version?
I wouldn't mind the comic book Metropolis that I grew up with being in Delaware. I would mind very much if the Metropolis of the current movies was in Delaware, because the movies are a little bit darker these days. So anymore, if the hero shows up, you gather your family and say your goodbyes. In the DC movies, like in The Man of Steel.
And it's not just Superman that calls Delaware home. Little-known Marvel villain, the Corruptor, actually claims Smyrna, Delaware, as his home.
In my own hometown of Smyrna, Delaware, there was a villain with purple skin and white hair and red eyes named the Corruptor, who was born there as a result of an industrial accident that I'm going to guess happened at a DuPont factory.
And while the Corruptor probably would not look great on a tourism poster, what about the Man of Steel?
I'm not sure whether Superman was from here or not, but we'll certainly claim him.
I do believe Delaware has missed the opportunity to claim it as the home of Superman. Delaware really needs to step up and own Superman and admit that the red, blue, and yellow is as important to the first state as the first state is to comics.
From the Delaware Desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
Philadelphia neighborhoods that were in decline have seen an influx of young professionals, many of whom feel stranded now by a lack of public transit in their areas. Every year, SEPTA considers suggestions for improving transit service, and the agency held an open house today to consider the public's opinion of this year's crop of potential service changes, known as the Annual Service Plan. WHYY's Jim Saxa reports.
Last year, SEPTA made more than a dozen changes to its annual service plan, including splitting its longest bus route, the 23, into two routes. That led to improved on-time performance on both. This year, there are two big proposals for brand new routes in Philadelphia. The first is for a new bus linking University City and its growing number of jobs with the more residential neighborhoods nearby. The proposed Route 49 bus would connect University City with Brewerytown and Fairmount to the north and Point Breeze and Grays Ferry to the south. Right now, there's no easy way of getting between those neighborhoods by public transit. Nick Rogers, who lives in South Philly, said he definitely used the new route.
Absolutely, yeah. It'd be great. Anytime I need to get to University City or 30th Street Station to get to Amtrak, you know, it's definitely something I can use.
SEPTA's other big idea is a new kind of express bus service along Roosevelt Boulevard. It would be Philadelphia's first step towards a bus rapid transit, or BRT, system, a kind of cheap and easy alternative to building new streetcar lines. SEPTA's manager of city service planning, Steve D'Antonio, explained what a BRT light service would entail.
We're looking at something that really emulates a rail line with station spacing that's much wider than normal, and we would actually call the bus stop stations.
Fewer stops means faster service. The new buses would run every 10 to 15 minutes during peak hours, which is almost as frequent as the subway, and would cut travel times between the Frankfurt Transportation Center and the Neshaminy Mall down to 34 minutes. That's just slightly slower than a car and way faster than taking the Route 14 bus today. The BRT light service would get its own name, like the Flash and the Lucy. SEPTA senior operations planner Dan Nemiroff said they'd take suggestions from the public for a name. One possibility, the Nor'easter. If approved, the changes would go into effect towards the tail end of 2017. For WHYY, I'm Jim Saxa.
Bullying prevention has become a rallying cry across the country. Since 2008, states have enacted 204 laws related to bullying, harassment, or intimidation in schools. Now contrast that with the nasty tone of this year's presidential election. It got us thinking, what's it like to discuss this rough-and-tumble election in today's schools? Avi Wolfman-Aaron from WHYY's Delaware desk went to find out.
I haven't walked more than 10 steps into Brandywine High School in North Wilmington when I see four different pamphlets on bullying. So it's a little odd when just a half hour later, I'm in Kenny Rivera's AP government class watching this.
You know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever.
Yes, that was Donald Trump back in August talking about Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly and her wherever. It's playing here because Rivera has asked his students to bring in examples of bullying on the campaign trail. They were happy to oblige him.
Wait, can we just watch all of them on the Republican
wait,
side?
Definitely please? Play mine. Mine's good.
Rivera's goal here isn't to revel in foul language or even to wag his finger at the candidates. It's to make a point about today's political discourse.
It's not presidential. It goes against the policies and bullying and everything else that we want them promoting and passing. Then why is this happening?
Alicia Corrado and Miguel Fuentes jump in.
I don't watch political candidate commercials. I'll shut them off right away. Yeah. But if they're negative ones, they're kind of funny. More amusing.
Well, hold your
I think a big part of it also is that we're all really ready to say it's hypocritical, it's silly, they shouldn't be doing it, it was childish. But then while they were playing, a second ago, we were all laughing.
Yeah. Rivera goes on to cite research about how effective these political attacks can be. He points out that Republican voter turnout is way up. It's a lively, candid conversation.
My belief, again, is, here I'm dealing with mainly 18-year-old students who need to learn how to have these discussions.
And the students seem to crave straight talk. Here's Ben Pradell.
A lot of the people that, I've talked to about political correctness are actually, against it. They think that people should speak their minds. Not everything is an easy conversation to have, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't have it whatsoever.
Delaware has passed three anti-bullying laws since 2012. A fourth may be on the way. Thanks to new reporting requirements, bullying incidents are cataloged, tracked, and compiled. A comment like this.
He doesn't sweat. He doesn't sweat because his pores are clogged from the spray tan that he uses.
Might go down as one of the 76 incidents related to physical appearance. While a riff like this one about a reporter with a congenital condition that affects how his joints move,
I don't know what I said, I don't remember,
might be filed under disability. But the changes in policy haven't discouraged teachers from taking on this election or showcasing some of the tactics used. Gary Block also teaches AP government at nearby AI DuPont High School.
There's really nothing I'd say I would shy away from, even in the tone of the campaign. Now, anything that they're talking about at a debate is worthwhile to bring into my government class and get their reactions to and help them learn from that.
And like Kenny Rivera students, Blocks seem eager to talk about this political campaign in particular. Here's Nia Wilson.
It's like a reality TV show, you love to hate it. It's like watching Real World Washington, D.C. You love it, but you're I would never trust any of them to do anything. When you see those TV shows, you're I wouldn't give them a plant to take care of. They're a mess, but you can't stop watching it. It's like a train wreck.
The laughter fades, though, when you head down a few grades.
It's a shame that kids are turning this on and we're trying to really teach them how to get along.
Mark Overly is the principal at Carcroft Elementary School, also in North Wilmington. The school takes bullying seriously. There are anti-bullying signs posted around the building. There's a confidential box where students can report if they feel threatened. On a recent Tuesday, while primary voters in other states were casting ballots, the school staff here received mindfulness training to help students deal with their emotions.
Inhale. Exhale.
So far, Overly says, the presidential race hasn't been a big topic among students, but he thinks that'll change. Every election year, Carcroft holds mock campaigns in the fall to teach the students about civics.
But I'll be honest, it's a little scary almost to bring it up right now, because I'd be afraid for kids to kind of see some of the slandering and just some of the awful things that the candidates are saying to each other.
Overly still believes the mock election will go on as planned, but he knows it may get tricky, particularly if, as he put it, certain people are representing different parties, in which case maybe he'll have to loan out his school's bullying box. From the Delaware desk, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
So if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all.
Still ahead, South Jersey artists get a chance to combine their talents.
We feel there's strength in numbers, and the more we know each other, the easier it is for people to perceive South Jersey as a real mecca for good artists.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Next time on I've Always Wondered.
So some people coupon for everything, and they have like 400 hot sauces, and that's not how I like to operate, because I know when there's a limit, I guess you could say.
I'm Molly Wood. Who really benefits from coupons? Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
The National Constitution Center proudly supports WHYY and presents America's Town Hall, discussing all sides of timely constitutional issues. Tickets are now available for The Future of Policing, a discussion on policing post-Ferguson, featuring former Philadelphia Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey on Thursday, March 31st. National Constitution Center CEO Jeffrey Rosen will moderate. Tickets for the March 31st America's Town Hall available at constitutioncenter.org.
A new art exhibition paired South Jersey photographers with South Jersey artists to create fine art portraits. The result? A collection of 16 photographs now on display at the Perkins Center for the Arts in Collingswood. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the show attests to the vibrancy of art in New Jersey.
Last winter, Susan Geitke, a photographer in Hamilton, was asked to make a portrait of sculptor Molly Carpenter. She had never heard of Carpenter, but instantly felt a kinship.
You know, we have similar dreams of water and bridges and mermaids and certain animals that she uses a lot over and over again in her work.
Geitke staged a highly conceptual portrait of Carpenter. It involves a mermaid, puddles of water in a 19th century house, and lots of Photoshop. Carpenter was only too happy to be part of it.
We're considered kind of the sleepy little enclave that's down here in this part of the state. But in actuality, there's a whole lot of very, very talented people here.
The name of this exhibition of 16 conceptual artist portraits is a pun on a camera shutter. It's called Click, as in a social click. It includes junkyard sculptor Bill Clark, Camden playwright Joseph Pabritsky, and classical flutist Megan Amy, captured in dramatic and often theatrical ways. The project was created by the New Jersey Arts Council, Art Pride New Jersey, and ArtC, a company promoting South Jersey artists. The president of ArtC, Bill Horan, says it connects artists to audiences and artists to each other.
We feel there's strength in numbers, and the more we know each other, the easier it is for people to perceive South Jersey as a real mecca for good artists.
Click will be on display in Collingswood until May, and then it moves to Millville. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
New research finds that Philadelphia community mental health clinics are relying more heavily on contractors rather than staff therapists, and that could impact patient outcomes. Mike and Scott reports from WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk.
Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health has been pushing for the use of evidence-based practices for almost a decade, for example, using cognitive behavioral therapy for depression and anxiety. UPenn psychologist Renat Beda set out to study the implementation of these treatments in community clinics. She found that clinics increasingly rely on contractors rather than salaried staff, and contractors were less familiar with the latest research-based treatments. She says her findings pose new research questions.
Understanding the impact of that shift on client outcomes seems very important, and really making sure that those folks are getting access to the types of professional development opportunities that salaried therapists have access to.
Betis found that clinic administrators were less likely to send contractor therapists to professional development workshops or to have them participate in in-house trainings. I'm Mike and Scott, WHYY News.
Losing sleep over asteroids heading for planet Earth? Well, there's a new non-prescription aid just on the market. Joining me to point us in the right direction is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, I stopped in CVS yesterday. They were apparently sold out of Atlas.
Atlas is a real lifesaver, and it's a potential planet saver, too. In this case, though, we're not talking about a sleep aid per se that we can take as a dose, but a sleep aid in the sense of we now have something else watching the skies for us as we sleep to protect us against incoming asteroids. This is the Asteroid Terrestrial Impact Last Alert System. NASA and other agencies around the world have done a great job at identifying the very biggest objects that could be what we call planet killers. But devising a system that can look for smaller objects has been much more challenging. So what the University of Hawaii has done is they've put together two telescopes, one on Mauna Loa in Hawaii and the other at the island of Haleakala. And what these two telescopes do together is they scan the skies looking for small objects that might cause some real damage.
How small?
Oh, maybe on the order of 50 meters in size, that small a size.
That could take out a city?
Well, if you consider how fast an object that size is coming into the Earth's atmosphere, it carries a tremendous amount of potential energy. These are objects that are a million times dimmer than the human eye can see. What the system does is it takes 1,000 images of the entire night sky every night.
When did this system become operational?
Well, it just became operational about a year and a half ago. It started out with one telescope. A second telescope has been added. Six more telescopes around the world will be added to the system so that we have a much more comprehensive view of the sky and we'll be able to tell if there are any objects of notable size heading towards us.
If and when an asteroid of sufficient size is observed, then what?
If we can identify something early enough, we can have early warning at the very least that something is imminent. If we have even earlier warning, several years, two decades, perhaps we can then mount some sort of off-planet defense to deflect an asteroid from actually hitting the Earth to help us avoid an uncomfortable situation.
Derek, apparently what's old in science fiction is new again.
Because NASA is about to install on board International Space Station a replicator. Not quite like the Star Trek replicator where you ask it for Earl Grey tea hot.
More like a 3D printer?
Yeah, exactly. Just like a 3D printer. In fact, this is a new version of a 3D printer that NASA tested on board International Space Station. One of those pieces that was made was actually a ratchet wrench. You know, like a normal wrench that we would use here on this planet. Now, here's the other interesting thing about it. Ground instructions and communications from Earth can email the design requirements to the device on board International Space Station and ask it to begin manufacturing right away. So let's say, for example, that you ask a 3D printer on board Space Station to make another 3D printer. Now, if that 3D printer makes yet another 3D printer, you can ask all three 3D printers to make more 3D printers. What you're developing is the capability to mass produce a lot of different pieces of equipment. So if we wanted to use building materials to construct colonies on the moon, well, we have to lift all that stuff from Earth. That makes it very expensive. So suppose we had this 3D printer capability with a genetically modified synthetic materials capability that can then make those materials in space.
This is sounding a lot like science fiction. Is it 10, 20, 100 years away?
Well, the 3D printer is now on board International Space Station. All we have to do is be careful that the 3D printers don't manufacture themselves over and over again and eventually take over Space Station.
And the universe.
And the universe!
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. You find Earth boring. Finally this evening, Philadelphia embarks on a month-long celebration of jazz starting April 1st. Jazz Appreciation Month will feature over 70 events. Christian McBride started his jazz career in Philadelphia and has 5 Grammys to his credit. He says Philly will always be his home and the place where he snuck into a bar underage to play with some of the city's greats.
The staff of Slim Cooper's, they say, okay, look, we'll let you play one song and then you got to go. So every Monday, I'm sorry, Mom, we would sneak the Slim Cooper's and just play one song. That was it, just one song. And then we will hustle back to West Philly.
So let's have Christian McBride take us out tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Support for WHYY comes from the Rutgers Camden Professional MBA Program. Designed for working professionals, the Rutgers Camden Professional MBA is a 21-month cohort-based program with classes held on Saturdays in 2 convenient locations, Camden and Princeton. The next cohort begins this fall. Rutgers' next information session is Wednesday, April 6th at 6 p.m. at the Cherry Hill Public Library in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Details at pmba.rutgers.edu or 856-225-2700.
The Greater Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce supports WHYY and congratulates this year's Talent Greater Philly Regional Challenge winners. Rowan University, AmeriHealth Caritas, Summer Search, and the District 1199C Training and Upgrading Fund for their commitment to educational advancement in our region. Talent Greater Philly works to amplify the region's efforts to increase post-secondary educational attainment. Learn more at talentgreaterphilly.org.
In Philadelphia, everyone is reading Cold Mountain by Charles Frazier. The Free Library of Philadelphia is celebrating the grand finale of 8 inspired weeks of One Book, One Philadelphia at the Parkway Central Library on March 30th at 7:30 p.m. with a panel discussion on the Black literary tradition, led by inaugural One Book author Laureen Carey, and a performance by cellist Udi Bar David. Details at freelibrary.org/onebook. The Free Library proudly supports WHYY.